Hello, and welcome to Lasting Values. I'm today's host, Della Sabesar, Global Head of Diversity and Inclusion at Credit Suisse. Our focus today, in the last part of this special series for Sustainability Week, is how companies and investors are pursuing growth sustainably. We're seeing a shift. Organizations are not just seeking to do no harm, but to do good, do better within their operations, and be at the forefront of positive economic, environmental, and social change. Paul Polman is no stranger to the idea that business can be a force for good. In his 10 years as CEO of Unilever, he integrated sustainability and human rights into a global business strategy.
In Unilever, it was very clear that when I came in 2008, the company wasn't doing as well as it should be doing. The financial market had created a little bit of a crisis out there that we had to deal with. So there was a burning platform for change. And what for me was very important is that we put this company back on the lasting, longer-term track of value creation. And in the beginning, that was kind of difficult because we made this Unilever Sustainable Living Plan that came out of a firm belief that we need to put all of our stakeholders in the center. Shareholder return being a result of what you do, and obviously attacking more aggressively the environmental, social, and governance factors, which have now become commonplace. When we started that journey, it was a fairly revolutionary plan. It created an employer brand that was pretty attractive. We had the third most looked up company after Google and Apple in the world, which we didn't quite understand because we're not a brand name by itself. Our engagement scores went to the top. But more importantly, it aligned ourselves with our partners in our value chain. We became more focused on what we were there for, to serve these needs of the citizens out there, and our innovation programs became more relevant and robust. And all of that eventually translated itself into shareholder results. And as we were doing this journey, it was as much of an effort to convince our employees. There's also a lot of skepticism out there. Is this another change program, a new CEO coming in, as it really was to change the financial market?
Speaking there at our recent Sustainability Week event, Paul demonstrated at Unilever that business can profit through purpose. Over his tenure, shareholders saw an increase of 290% in terms of returns, while the company consistently ranked as the number one in the world for sustainability and also as a top employer. Fast forward 15 years, and now we have evidence and more of an accepted belief that responsible, all-encompassing business models are actually driving financial returns. But Paul says some things are still missing: scale and speed.
Everybody knows we have an issue of climate change. Everybody knows we have an issue of inequality. COVID actually pushed us back a little bit on this famous sustainable development goals that you are familiar with. But now we need to rally the troops, if you want to, and create this collective action that's a little bit more courageous to close that gap again. And it's difficult for each company individually to do that. So that's why collective action is as much part of it as this individual courage to set the right targets and objectives. And that is what we're focused on right now, and we're starting to see some movement that should give us encouragement.
When it comes to collective movement, Ownership Works wants to create at least $20 billion of wealth for lower income and diverse workers over the next decade. How? By increasing prosperity through shared ownership at work. The nonprofit organization says that providing all employees with a stake in the value they help create is not just better business and smarter investing, it's also the right thing to do. I caught up with Annalisa Miller, the executive director at Ownership Works.
Shared ownership is pretty simple. It's including all employees in the opportunity to participate in the value that they help create at work. So typically in a company, ownership among employees tends to be concentrated within a handful of senior executives. So what we're doing is we're working with investors and corporate leaders to expand ownership from that handful to all of the employees, giving them an opportunity to become owners and really change not just their opportunity to financially benefit from the value that they help create, but also be part of a better work environment where they really feel, think, and act and are treated like owners. There's a few key characteristics of a shared ownership program that I'd just like to highlight. So first, we think of this as broad-based. So we'd like to see a pathway to ownership for all employees. Second, these programs should be meaningful. So we work right now with a lot of private equity firms who are implementing these programs in their portfolios. So we've defined meaningful as programs that would provide 6 to 12 months of salary for employees at the exit, assuming the investor hits their base case. Third, this should be a free and incremental benefit for low and moderate income workers. We don't want employees putting themselves at risk of losing capital they can't afford to lose. And then finally, these programs should be part of a holistic program that's not just sharing ownership, but building out a culture of ownership that's enhancing employee engagement and promoting the employee's overall financial well-being.
In agreement with Annalisa, Paul has seen the positive correlation between employee shared ownership and company performance.
We certainly have seen in Unilever that when we started implementing a broad share plan across the organization, it has definitely been a key enabler to move the engagement up. There's no question in my mind. Okay. If you see what happens with the global economies, you take the US, for example, over the last four decades, we've lost half of the publicly traded companies. Mm. All the value creation is in the capital markets. And de facto, by running these companies for the shorter term, excluding many people from that capital value creation, we've actually increased the gap between the haves and have-nots. So this world will not function without dignity and respect and equity.
Dignity, equity, respect, diversity. We want this for all. And a just transition means moving to a more sustainable green economy in a way that's fair to everyone. But what does a just transition mean for companies and investors? Paul says it has two dimensions.
It has the global dimension. What we have seen in COVID was that you can't have healthy people on an unhealthy planet. But the ones that were suffering were the ones that already suffered before. They were in jobs that were more fragile. They were living in areas where the effects of climate change were more evident. More poorer people live around coal mines than richer people. They were the first ones that suffered from the disruptions that we saw in our supply chain. The food prices that have gone up tremendously, they usually spend a higher proportion of their income on food. So in a transition on a macro level to create this more sustainable, inclusive global economy that works for everybody now and for generations to come, we have to be sure that we close that inequality gap. That's a just transition. Every company should think about their plans of what they do to close the gap. When I did my Unilever Sustainable Living Plan, we created 5 million jobs for smallholder farmers. But we also wanted to be sure that half of them were women. We started the Living Wage Alliance to be sure that they could send their kids to school and have at least the possibility of improving their lives. And then there's the micro level of just transition, which I best describe as it's very difficult to convince the unions or the coal miners to close a coal mine and to move to green energy if they all lose their jobs. It just doesn't work that way. So at the micro level, we have to be sure that as we make this enormous transition in society, that we take care of the car workers who have made the combustion engine and train them to make the electric vehicles. The coal miners who've given us energy for a long time, that we train them to be in green, be it hydrogen, wind, solar, or other green energy. So that's a tremendous investment in transformations of these economies, and that's also called just transition. And what we find is that this green economy creates more jobs, creates better jobs, creates more resilient jobs. So it actually does make a lot of sense.
Now, the founder of outdoor clothing company Patagonia recently gave away his company to Mother Nature instead of selling it to private investors. 100% of Patagonia's capital and voting rights were transferred to two entities responsible for protecting the planet. In a letter addressed to his 3,650 employees, he proclaimed that our one and only shareholder is our home planet. And companies are even going beyond climate change when it comes to doing good. Paul has co-authored the book Net Positive, a courageous call to corporate leaders of disruptive innovators around the world to reframe the purpose of their companies to be net positive. Net positive strategies are built on the idea that a company must give back more than it takes from society and the environment.
If you go to Glasgow at the COP26, if you look at the sustainability reports of the 92% of companies that now issue them, you find commitments of a little bit less carbon in the atmosphere, a little bit less deforestation in the value chain, a little bit less plastics in the ocean. But when you've overshot these planetary boundaries, a little less simply isn't good enough anymore. So we need to get this mindset from CSR, corporate social responsibility, to move to what I call RSC, responsible social corporations. And that is really the idea with Net Positive. Help companies in that transition in a very practical way. Start with your own leadership, your company transformation, and then the broader transformations. And for us, Net Positive companies are first and foremost the ones that take responsibility of that total impact in the world, all consequences, intended or not. Many think they can outsource their value chain and outsource their responsibilities. Doesn't work anymore. Net Positive companies work for the longer term to address these broader issues. Think about multiple stakeholders. Understand that you need shareholder return, but see it as a result of what you do, not as a myopic objective. And last but not least, they're involved in these broader transformations that we now need in society. And we ask ourselves a very simple question in the book: how can you profit from solving the world's problems, not creating them? And is the world better off because your company is in it, yes or no? And I'm not so sure how many yet can answer that in the affirmative.
The disruptive ideas are there, but how can we get investors and companies on board? In the case of shared ownership, Annalisa says the social and business benefits of programs really speak for themselves.
So when you look at the social benefits of the program, it's pretty clear that these can create meaningful wealth-building opportunities for employees, right? The second thing they can do is really help promote racial equity. So when you look at senior management, tends to lack diversity. When you push ownership through all levels of a company, you're going to pick up more diverse workers, more women. The third thing that it can do is it can improve employee experience and employee engagement, and then improve financial capability as long as the programs include some financial literacy training, which is really critical.
Now, Annalisa says you're not going to magically change a business just because you've shared ownership with everybody. But a concerted effort to build out a culture of ownership will see some real benefits to the business.
So what we see in these companies who do it well is improvements in employee engagement, decreases in turnover, an ability to attract and retain more workers. And you can also see if the company aligns certain objectives with the programs, that these programs could really help drive those outcomes. And then we won't say that shared ownership is a direct line to improve financial performance. There are just too many variables along the way. But what we can feel confident saying is that employee ownership can impact employee engagement, impact retention, impact other operational goals, and all of those things can have a positive impact on the company's financial performance.
Working with the private sector right now, Annalisa says when it comes to shared ownership, it's all about changing the mindset of who's creating value for a company and challenging the status quo.
We've been really encouraged by the time that the private equity firms that we work with, the banks that we work with, have taken out of their days to just listen to a new idea. And it takes many, many meetings, right, to socialize these new ideas, to shift people away from business as usual to something else. But we found that we've made some progress in just that initial mindset shift and receptivity. And I really think that that shift in mindset, that receptivity, that proof of concept, and then paired with some investment on the part of the government to promote this, and we can get to a place where I think more and more companies will make this part of their routine way of compensating their employees.
In the private sector, some may say there is a conflict between short-term investor expectations and the long-term goals of a company.
Well, I think, first of all, there is a fallacy that people say it's the financial market that pushes you to the short term, which is obviously not helping you when you address these major issues like food security or climate change. They need long-term solutions. The reality is that more pressure is coming actually from your own boards or your own incentive systems with the CEOs. And if you really take the bulk of the financial market, which are the pension funds and the institutional investors, they've increasingly discovered that they not only want a return in 20, 30, 40 years when we all retire, but also that we want a world to retire in. And if you look at the Sustainable Development Goals, you know, the investments that we need to make to eradicate poverty, to move to this sustainable economy that we aspire to, is probably about $5 to $6 trillion a year. We only do 2 to 3 trillion a year. And that gap has to come from the private sector. That gap has to come from money flowing in that right direction. And what we need to do first and foremost there is look at the risks that get in the way and work together to eliminate some of these risks. So these partnerships that are being formed, like the Net Zero Alliance, the First Mover Alliance, the Race to Zero partnerships, the banking alliances too. And then last but not least, I think, you know, gravitate towards credibility and quality. The voluntary carbon market is a very important thing. It will be a big source of income for many of the banks, the natural capital. But we have to be sure, I think, that we keep a high level of credibility. There's a lot of skepticism out there that voluntary initiatives are to the benefit of the shareholders. And to be honest, we have to prove that these voluntary initiatives, if we do them, which always will be faster than governments can move, have a high level of integrity and indeed address issues like just transition or truly get to the issues of solving climate change.
Annalisa says financial solutions are an engine of our economy. She says the private sector needs to move away from a place of shareholder and bottom line primacy to instead take account of how business decisions affect all stakeholders.
We're already at a place of crisis, and it's going to be right on our front doors in terms of what's happening with the climate, with economic inequality, and with the social unrest that will fall from all of that. So I think for financial institutions to really keep front and center how their decisions around how they allocate capital, the products and services that they offer, how that is contributing to these critical issues needs to be front and center for how folks are doing their business. So I think that there's a way that the financial institutions can amplify what we're doing in public settings where you're out educating folks and talking about ESG, in individual conversations with business owners, and then with your products, right? Is there a way that you can incentivize shared ownership through the financial products that you're creating and putting in front of businesses as a way to promote a better future?
What does the future of sustainable growth look like? Paul says that because the world hasn't acted fast enough, the cost of not acting is actually becoming higher than the cost of acting, which is what makes it such an important financial opportunity. We've heard that challenging business as usual approaches can be good for the bottom line, as well as for companies and society as a whole. Annalisa concludes our chat by explaining why these new ideas, new ways of working, give her hope for the future.
So as a young person, I really believed in the American dream. But there's so much exceptionalism involved in that narrative, right? What are we doing, you know, systemically to create more and more pathways for people to realize financial security for today and for the future? But that said, I think that, you know, all of the new ideas that are on the table and these conversations that are happening to find ways to, you know, address these issues and find new pathways, I have to stay optimistic, you know, that we're going to do better and that we'll find new ways. And I'm optimistic because I think it's really, it comes down to individuals. And I'm seeing, you know, individuals sit back and say, what can I do in my own company, in my own backyard? I can't wait for the government. I can't wait for, you know, what can I do today to make a difference? And I get to see in my day-to-day job, CEOs and investors making that decision. And that leaves me optimistic about the future for sure.
So hit the follow button on Apple or Spotify to listen in to more from Lasting Values, the sustainability podcast by Credit Suisse.
Should a bank clean up the ocean? We engage with companies creating ocean impact and preventing plastic pollution practices. We're on it.
The information provided herein constitutes general marketing material. It is not investment advice, nor otherwise based on a consideration of the personal circumstances of the addressee, nor is it a result of objective or independent research. The information provided herein is not legally binding, and it does not constitute an offer or invitation to enter into any type of financial transaction. The information provided herein was produced by a member of Credit Suisse Group AG and or its affiliates, hereafter CS, with the greatest of care and to the best of its knowledge and belief. The information and views expressed herein are those of CS at the time of writing and are subject to change at any time without notice. they are derived from sources believed to be truthful and reliable. CS provides no guarantee with regard to the completeness and accuracy of the information, and where legally possible, does not accept liability for any direct, indirect, incidental, specific, or consequential losses that might arise from making use of the information. If nothing is indicated to the contrary, all figures are unaudited. The information provided herein is solely for information purposes and the exclusive use of the recipient, and is not intended and should not be construed as legal, accounting, tax, nor financial advice provided by CS. If this material is issued and distributed in the US, it is by CSSU, a member of NYSE, FINRA, SIPC, and the NFA, and CSSU accepts responsibility for its contents. Clients should contact their sales representative and execute transactions through a Credit Suisse subsidiary or affiliate in their home jurisdiction, unless governing law permits otherwise. This material is intended for institutional investors only, not for retail distribution. It may not be reproduced, neither in part nor in full, without the prior written permission of CS. Important information for investors in Germany. The information and views expressed herein are those of CS at the time of writing and are subject to change at any time without notice. They are derived from sources believed to be reliable. CS provides no guarantee with regard to the content and completeness of the information. If nothing is indicated to the contrary, all figures are unaudited. The information provided herein is for the exclusive use of the recipient. Copyright 2021 Credit Suisse Group AG and/or its affiliates. All rights reserved.